Call the meeting of Senate Transportation to order. It is 1:30, and I'd like to introduce staff at first. Staff to Senate Transportation for this meeting, Alita Buss, Chief of Staff. Secretary is Ann Krekelberg, and the teleconference operator is Kathleen Nyssen. Sorry, I'm losing my voice. We have three bills to take up today. Senate Bill 53, Aircraft Emergency Rations and Equipment, presented by Senator Olson. Senate Bill 177, Regulation of Towers, Senator Olson. And Senate Bill 178, Vehicle Rental Tax, Senator Bishop. First, Senate Bill 153, and I'd like to announce the members, Senator Faircloth. Vice Chair Senator Dyson was here. Senator French and Senator Bishop. And Senator Dyson is here. So, first on the agenda is Senate Bill 53, Aircraft Emergency Rations and Equipment. David Scott. Mr. Scott, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm David Scott, staff to Senator Olson. The bill in front of the committee at this time, Senate Bill 53, was introduced by the sponsor to kind of update the Alaska statutes to current industry standards to include a lot more sophisticated safety and locator equipment, allowing for emergency response. And the if you look at the bill, Section 1 adds some conforming language to what we do in Section 2. Section 2 of the bill is new language, and where we add that the requirements under A of the section, which is in Section 1, do not apply to an operator if they are following required from FAA, that was already required by FAA to carry for their operations. If there's a commercial aircraft carrier equipped with real-time satellite tracking systems, or a commercial aircraft equipped with a 406 megahertz emergency locator transmitter. These are commonly referred to as, in the maritime industry, EPIRBs, and in the aviation industry, ELT, and it stands for Emergency Locating Transmitter, I believe is what it is. This bill was brought to us from the industry, from the aviation industry in Alaska, and the sponsor feels that it's worthy of a passage. Obviously, we would have introduced it. We do have members from the aviation industry, from a trade group, and individual members who are willing to testify in support of this. I can answer any questions about the bill if you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Scott. Questions for Mr. Scott before we take testimony. Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Chair Egan. Could you talk to me a little bit about the ambiguity? How is it being interpreted differently? Thank you.
Through the Chair, Senator Faircloth, the law has never really been legally defined. And if you look at if you pull out the statute books and look at it now, you can't tell whether or not the law applies to an aircraft that did not start its flight in Alaska and will not end its flight in Alaska, but travels through Alaskan airspace. And that's never been settled. It's very ambiguous and has laws written now, and it's never been settled really by law. And so another part of the bill was to try to get mitigate that the ambiguity in the current law as it's written.
Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems like what we're proposing to not require an airplane to carry are life-saving measures. And so could you speak to the committee about the type of equipment now that airplanes carry that wouldn't have someone stranded for a week at a time in a remote location, and that's I am wanting to put on the record why the sponsor believes that the exceptions now are being provided versus carrying that life safety equipment that has been required to be carried, at least of smaller aircraft, in the past.
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, with the advent of satellite communications and miniaturization of technology, that emergency devices such as beacons or ELTs, or like I said, EPIRBs, emergency operate, if there was ever what's called in the aviation industry, they call it an unplanned landing. I guess that's a crash. If there's ever an incident, the ELT would activate, and emergency operations, weather permitting, emergency operations get there very quickly.
Senator Faircloth, follow-up.
Mr. Chairman, the only thing I'm thinking about is the life safety of the passengers that might be on board any particular aircraft, and whether it's good to have this particular equipment on the aircraft, and if so, at what quantity. And so I'll listen to those that are speaking in favor of the legislation. I understand there's a cost of fuel in carrying excess weight. There's food that probably ages out, so there's a replacement issue for the food that they're carrying. I found it amazing, though, that we were going to keep mosquito nets as one of the three items that would be carried on some of the craft. So I do know that mosquitoes can be very troubling and could be life-threatening, depending on how much skin you have exposed in some areas. So I'll listen to the testimony, Mr. Chairman. I think we're getting there.
Thank you, Senator. We do have people online to testify. We also have a person in the audience to testify, Jane Dale from Willow, Alaska Air Carriers Association. Jane, are you online?
Hi, yes, I am. My name is Jane Dale. I'm with the Alaska Air Carriers Association and here to support SB 53 and appreciate this opportunity to allow the language to be updated to current technology and practices. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your brevity and your testimony. Thank you. It's appreciated. Next to testify, Bab Ajudovich, Fairbanks, President and CEO of Air Alaska.
Hello. Can you hear me okay? This is Bob Ajudovich with Air.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry, Bob, because I thought it was Bob, but it says Bab. So I apologize.
I've been called worse.
Okay. Me too. Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. Go ahead and testify. Thank you.
Okay, yeah. Thank you for having me today in support of Senate Bill 53. There's been a lot of ambiguity in this particular state law for years, but it was really never taken out of context until a couple of years ago when the FAA started to interpret the state law in addition to the FARs, or the Federal Aviation Regulations. And they were started to question carriers, air carriers that were flying through the state or over the airspace, as to why they weren't in compliance with the state law. And this had never been enforced since its inception, because as a state law, it was enforceable by the state troopers. The state troopers never came out to the air carriers and said, you know, we want to make sure you have the survival equipment on the aircraft. It's my understanding the original intent of this was to try to capture non-commercial pilots flying up from the lower 48 into the state of Alaska and coming into the state very unprepared for anything that would happen to their aircraft. They had the potential for having to put your aircraft down and be able to survive for a week was really a critical component of that original law. And as things evolved, you know, the concept of satellite technology and as Mr. Scott pointed out, the 406 ELTs and giving immediate satellite locations or GPS locations on downed aircraft that are activated upon impact. Things have changed today where the worst thing you can kind of worry about is the accessibility to the accident scene. And that certainly is not, the standard has not been a week. This got elevated at our company because the FAA specifically was trying to hold us accountable in our Dash 8 equipment, which has 37 seats, and in particular the requirement to carry a sleeping bag per person. We'd have to put 37 sleeping bags on the Dash 8. And we retorted with, well, don't you have to have Alaska Airlines and China Airways and Lufthansa and anybody else that flies into the Anchorage airport, don't they all have to be in compliance with the same law? And the gentleman said yes. And so we brought it all the way to Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. basically said, well, it's between the operator and the FAA, but you still need to be in compliance with the state law. So that's where we started looking at trying to clarify this law as to its original intent. I think it's still smart to have private pilots in the state and small aircraft carry survival gear. I think it's also smart to have a 406 ELT, and if they do have that, then to waive certain other requirements, I think is a fair trade-off, because the best thing we've done for safety in aviation in the last 50 years has been the immediate location of a downed aircraft. So I support the efforts that SB 53 takes.
Great, thank you.
The only question I would have is possibly, we talk about real time in number item sub item D2. It says real time satellite tracking systems, possibly defining the term real time. There's a little bit of redundancy in the items 1, 2, 3, and 4. I would fear that item 1 could possibly exempt every aircraft, and so I don't think that was the intent. But if item number 1 is intended to mean that, for example, if the FAA requires us to have the equipment in the aircraft and you're in compliance with that, then you're exempt from the state requirement. That's okay. But what if the FAA doesn't have a requirement, for example, Part 91 or non-commercial, doesn't really address safety equipment in the aircraft required by the FAA. So if there's a void in the FAA requirement, does sub-item number 1 still exempt a person from carrying survival equipment in their aircraft in the state by virtue of the fact there's a void from the FAA? That sub-item number 1 could probably be tightened up a hair just to make sure that we don't get unintended consequences.
Great. Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Scott, did you want to reply to that?
Mr. Chairman, it's something that we're willing to look at and tweak it if we have to. There's no, it seems like a good suggestion. We'll definitely take a look at it.
Great, thank you. And we do have, do we have anybody else online sign up to testify? We don't. So we have a person in the audience, Mike Stedman. Mike, Alaska Seaplanes on the AACA board. Welcome, Mike, and provide your testimony.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chairman.
If you can give your name for the record, please.
My name is Mike Stedman, co-owner of Alaska Seaplanes, Air General, also on the Air Carrier Board. I think I wasn't sure Bob was going to call in, and he pretty much covered my testimony as well. And, with the advent of ADS-B, which is real-time tracking, which many aircraft have now, and that's the wave of the future, along with spider tracks, you can actually track your airplane and Anchorage Center can track them. And so the ability to go out and find a downed aircraft have been enhanced substantially in the last few years. The technology has really evolved. So I support this bill and like to see it pass with the few changes that Bob had mentioned. So.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Stedman. Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for either of you. My memory serves me. We used to require them to carry a rifle or firearm, and when that was true, that got cross-threaded with people that were flying into Canada. Am I wrong?
I believe you're correct, yes.
And that requirement, if I may continue, has gone away?
The way I read the bill, it's actually not in there.
Right.
So I would say that would be correct.
All right. Thank you.
Through the chair very quickly, Senator Dyson, if you look at AS 0235110A, you'll have the whole list of what's there, and there's nothing, there's no rifle on the list of what's required. This is a hatchet, a knife, first aid kit, hooks and lines for fishing, and some signaling pistols, but not a 38 or 9mm.
Believe it or not, I can read.
Okay. All right.
I did go to public school, but taught well.
Further questions, Senator Dyson? Senator French.
Thank you. I wonder if someone can describe for the record what it is the FAA requires in the way of equipment for operations within the state or over uninhabited areas, since we're basically saying this whole list we painstakingly developed is going to be wiped away if the aircraft is equipped as required by the FAA. So what do they require? What are those requirements?
Through the chair, Senator French, there's a CFR code. It's title, so it's 14 CFR 121.353. Should be along with your
in packet. The
packet. Mm-hmm. And it's titled Emergency Equipment for Operations Over Uninhabited Terrain.
One second.
Electronic,
this one. Okay, very good. So you've got to have pyrotechnic devices, in survival type emergency locator transmitter, and survival kits appropriately equipped for the route to be flown and the number of occupants of the airplane. And I'm guessing that we don't know what that survival kit word means, that's as far as it goes. Or is there?
Through the chair, Senator French, I could not find what exactly. I tried to dig deeper into that, and I could not. I do have a call in to try to talk to somebody at the federal level, but I couldn't find that. Or I even asked my boss, who's a pilot, so I couldn't find that exact. But
right. I mean, you see the question.
Appropriately equipped,
right?
It's hard to.
They could say, "Here's your survival kit, which is a Clif Bar." And say we got one for everybody, and now we're in compliance with the FAA, so there's no blankets, there's no snowshoes, there's no fire starter, there's no knife, there's no mosquito netting, there's no nothing. And that's just one lingering question. Two, I always have to be reminded, when you see a series of 1, 2, and 3, 4, are those ands or ors? That is, if you're equipped in D1, 2, 3, 4, do you have to have each one of those things to escape the requirements of A, or just any one of them?
Through the chair, Senator French, that's a great question. I guess as I read it, they were ORs. If I could check with the drafter.
Well, you got an and on line 20.
On line 20,
right.
Yes.
And that leads to my last question, which is 4 seems to be a combination of 2 and 3, which does seem, I think one of the witnesses said, it seems a little redundant. To say it's okay, as 2 says, you can have a real-time satellite tracking system, then you're okay. Or you can have a 406 megahertz ELT, that's okay. Or you can have one with both. But then it says installed and operational, which leads me to believe that maybe the first 2, that's not the case. You see what I'm saying? It seems funny to have it blatantly say they got to be installed and operated in the last one, but not for the first 2. I mean, I got to believe... You know, the thing's got to be installed and operational to make it count. So I guess I would either add it to all 3 or add it to none of them. It's just a drafting issue, in my view. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator French. Mr. Scott, you wouldn't be opposed to holding this over till next week?
Not at all, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike, welcome.
Thank you. Yeah,
along Senator French's line of questioning, on number 4, a commercial aircraft carrier in airspace over the state is equipped with real-time satellite tracking system da-da-da-da, installed and operational. That's the key word where I'm zoning in on. So this bill pretty much goes to 135 operators?
Well, through the chair, Senator Bishop, the word commercial carrier is 135, 121, part 135, part 121.
Okay, so either one of those, if this wasn't, if you were on a Alaska Airlines 737 trying to push back from the gate, and either one of those two weren't operational here in Juneau, we wouldn't roll right until they were.
That would be correct. As far as the 406 megahertz, those aren't required for transport category jets. So I would read this as being more of the smaller aircraft. Alaska Airlines, the large aircraft, they're basically in radar environment almost continuous. The exception is in southeast here and some other parts of the state where you're down lower, like on approach, you would be out of radar coverage for a short period of time.
To follow up, sir, but we would still be on RNP or GPS.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. You're on IFR flight plan. There are some instances where they can fly VFR. For instance, between Petersburg and Wrangell, there's certain requirements that have to be met where they can fly VFR. And of course, it's a real short distance, so there wouldn't be, you're not talking a 1,000-mile area, so it's fairly small confined area.
Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Stedman or Mr. Scott? Seeing none, it's the intention of the committee, then I'm sorry, Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following up on Senator French, if we're going to take the time to look at this, we probably need to go back into Section 1. And even though it's not being, it's been amended, but if you go to number 2 on page 2, line 7, again, those are ands, it looks like. And so we're carrying a sleeping bag and a one-wool blanket on top of that for the smaller plane. So we probably need to look and see if that needs to be amended to say or, because apparently we would want a set of snowshoes and either a sleeping bag or a wool blanket. Maybe, if you're trying to define it. And then I'm wondering why, so that we don't have to go back into state statute, if we believe the federal government has set appropriate code for survival, that we're not tying it directly and linking it with this so that when it changes, we know it changes and our statutes are automatically updated. So when we're referring to Federal Aviation Administration, I'm wondering if we should just quote this and then if we're worried about what it means for a survival kit, I don't know if you want to describe it. Because basically we just don't want the weight, and at least that's how I'm tracking the sponsor's intent. We want to try to make it easy for a carrier to provide safety to those that are on the plane and eliminate wool blankets and sleeping bags if it's not necessary.
Mr. Scott, you got that?
Mr. Chairman, I got it all.
So I'm assuming you'll be coming back next week with the CS?
I'll be talking to you tomorrow, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Further questions of Mr. Scott? Great. Thank you, David. Thanks, Mike, for testifying. And we'll hold this until next week. Next is Senate Bill 177, Regulation of Towers. Mr. Scott, you're in the hot seat again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm David Scott, staff to Senator Olson. The bill in front of you, Senate Bill 177, is another take on aviation safety. And we know that the sponsor is aware of concerns out there, and he's under no he feels that the bill does need to be worked on, but he thanks you for hearing it because he wants to get it up and get this issue taken care of, and he's willing to work with other concerned parties on the bill and have a very open process here. And having said that, I'll start the bill here. The Section 1 relates to registering and marking of tower structures, and what we're going for. And the intent of the bill was for communication structures, wind towers, and there's also another. It's called a MET. It's a meta. It's basically a wind or a weather tower. That you know, they go up quite high, and so they can be a very scary and very dangerous thing for a pilot to not know exactly where these things are. And so we would like to, Section 1 would require the marking and painting and of towers and also the registering of towers with DOT. There's also other little things on there about the spherical marker balls. There's the big orange balls that you see on guy wires and stuff of that nature. There are a couple requirements in here for owners of towers, and that's for them to register with the department by a certain date. I think it's 20 days before installation of a new tower, and then I think we give them 45 or 15 days after, if this bill passes, they'd have 15 days to register where their tower's at with the department. We state that the tower owner should comply with all federal laws and standards related to lighting, painting, and visibility of a tower. FAA
FCC.
And FCC are also involved. And it's still a question as to who does the enforcement on that kind of stuff. And so I can't find out necessarily if it is FAA or FCC, but it is something that I'm actively looking into at the time. There's also, we have a person who violates this shall be punished as provided in 1255, and 1255 is the criminal code. Let's see, we have there's a transitional section, and that is the registering, where they have, we give them 45 days from the time of the act. So, and after that, they would be subject to violation punished under 1255. The sponsor has put this forward, and as he's an active pilot, he's had air taxis, and he feels that there should be some sort of standard in Alaska on the construction of towers and the marking of towers. And we do know that, like I said, there's some concern out there, and the sponsor's under no illusion that this is going to be the exact bill that passes, if it passes.
Yeah, hang on, David. Question from Senator Dyson.
Thank you. I agree with the sponsor that it needs to happen. It's a bad hair day running into a tower. I was struck by the fact that it doesn't require a strobe light, you know, that's operational. A lot of people fly at night, and some folks feel it gets quite dark here in the wintertime in some locations. So I'd appreciate it as you go forward with this. Explain that one to me.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, of course, I'll definitely have an answer for you on that one.
And I would, in your place, I think there's already some existing law, but maybe federal, about transmission towers in and around airstrips.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, you're correct. I believe I found it. I'd like to review it one more time. But it's, I believe the FAA has a purview over that if the towers are above 200 feet. And there's a proximity thing, that a proximity
to airport
gate to get, you know, that they have to go through near airports. So.
Yeah, just to follow up, I like your 100 foot, but I'll let people with a lot more experience and smaller craft and bush strips than me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions for Mr. Scott, Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Scott, Anchorage has a tower ordinance already, and so I'm wondering if other cities specifically communities with airports already have some local ordinances going. Have we collaborated with them to know what's going on with those local communities? I remember working on a tower ordinance in Anchorage some years ago.
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, I have not talked to any municipalities at all. I'll definitely reach out, though, and, you know, we don't want to, you know, everything should go forward together. We think, you know, we don't want to create a checkerboard effect on how this is for the pilots, for the industry.
Mr. Chairman, I would just echo Senator Dyson's comments that if we have some federal guidelines that are next to airports already, we might want to take a look at those and see how we can be consistent and then talk to our small service providers that might be going into some of the smaller communities to see what that looks like in cost for those airports or those communities to change. We might want to give a period of time to bring people on instead of penalizing them in 1 year to have everything done. Beside the fact, I noticed one of our wind projects will cost $120,000 to just do what is suggested here. I think the total cost was closer to above $240,000, but that's just one project. So there could be quite a bit of economic impact, though, as Senator Dyson said, and obviously Senator Olson, that, you know, safety is the first priority here. So what can we do to accomplish the task and try to move the identification closer?
Senator Fairclough, yeah, we had the same issue here in Juneau. In fact, it happened last night. There's a prohibition on construction of cell towers now until the city adopts an ordinance that regulates cell tower use. And one of the main issues is lighting. So maybe you can look at what the city's and Borough of Juneau is doing too.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I can. There's no problem. I'm from Ketchikan. I live downtown in Ketchikan, and there's a big radio tower right down there. And for about 2 weeks, there was a super bright light on there, and then people started making phone calls, and they took it down. So
you don't want to see them. Senator French.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think we all know what a tower is in our minds, but I'm not sure if we're defining it with enough clarity in this bill. And I wonder if the municipality of Anchorage or Juneau has some other definition of tower to exclude, for example, buildings greater than 100 feet in height, or whether we need to include buildings, all buildings over 100 feet in height. It's something I think we should at least be clear about.
Mr. Scott, further questions for Mr. Scott? We do have people signed up to testify. We have Robert Day, Kenai Homer Electric Association. Mr. Day, are you online? Mr. Day? Okay, let's try.
This is Mr. Day. Sorry, I don't have anybody here to help me with the phone.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead. We hear you loud and clear.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today. As mentioned, my name is Robert Day. I'm an engineer with Homer Electric. I'm glad to hear that the sponsor of the bill is open to a little tweaking or working on this bill, because as I read this bill, I think I understand what the intent is, but I am a little concerned that in my particular business that it may overreach and cause quite a bit of an expense for Homer Electric or the other electric utilities throughout Alaska. The APA has responded, or the AEA has responded, that most of their towers are less than 100 feet and would not fall under this bill. I'm unsure of the towers that feed Juneau from Snettisham. I think they would possibly fall under this bill and could be meet the requirement of being larger than 100 feet. There's also quite a body of information or regulation from the FAA and the airports that require marking of structures near airport facilities. But in this bill, I'm a little concerned about, say, our transmission towers that traverse very remote areas of Alaska, and they can be near some small airport or waterway and could fall under this this bill. And it sounds a little silly, but these towers, our towers, our transmission towers, carry electricity, but it's electricity that's not very conducive to powering signal lights. And so placing signal lights on each and every tower would be pretty expensive and onerous. And any kind of maintenance would more than likely require an outage on that transmission line, which has some big economic effects. But more of concern is the 50-foot structure, where we would be required to register and keep up-to-date information on all of these. Very many of our distribution poles and all of our transmission towers would fall under the 50-foot regulation, and I'm concerned there that that also falls under this, make them visible when they get near the airport. Again, we have a body of rules and regulations when we work at the airport that hopefully keep those things safe. I am concerned that the requirement for registration, and then this information would be put on some public web page, would fall afoul of the critical infrastructure homeland security rules. We've been a lot more, shall we say, coy about putting information in the public area about electrical systems and how they're built and how they're interconnected since the activities of 9/11. So we would find ourselves possibly in a Hobson's choice there of obeying one law and breaking another. The marking of the guy wires, we very often here in Alaska use a steel transmission structure that has guy wires on both sides of it, and that'd be an awful lot of marker balls if we had to mark all the transmission towers, say from Bradley Lake all the way into Soldotna substation. I would suggest to the sponsor of the bill that just a simple exemption for towers that are primarily for the transmission of electrical power or distribution of electrical power might solve this problem. Of course, if somebody put a communication tower on top of an electrical transmission tower, I think it would fall under this legislation. We'll also follow this up with a letter to Senator Olson, and I thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Day. Questions for Mr. Day? Great. Thank you for your testimony. Next to testify, Jane Dale. Welcome again, Jane, Alaska Air Carriers Association.
Hi, my name is Jane Dale. I'm with the Alaska Air Carriers Association, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of SB 177. Just to answer a couple questions, I appreciate the comments from the gentleman ahead of me. The FAA does have requirements for the public to submit a notice of proposed construction when a tower or obstruction is greater than 200 feet or in general within 2 to 4 miles of a public use airport, depending on the length of that airport. The FAA does consider drafting aeronautical recommendations, and the enforcement of FAA's recommendations are done through others. The FCC would be responsible for the enforcement for communication towers, and really statewide or local regulations appear to be the enforcement tool for other obstructions. So this ordinance we support because it would provide some predictability in the airspace for carriers and aviators statewide so that they would be able to visually see day or night obstructions greater than 100 feet or could look them up in a registry for obstructions greater than 50 feet. And again, I appreciate the comments and before and certainly support looking into some of the requirements.
Great, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ms. Dale. And Senator Dyson has a question or a comment.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just starting to get thinking about this, and I appreciate it coming forward. Do you know well, first of all, I assume that all structures like this that stick up some height start showing up on aeronautical charts. And I'd like to know what that process is and how practical that is and how soon they do. And then, of course, I assume that electronic charts that are increasingly used, that process happens and can happen sooner. And maybe you're not the right person to answer that question, but I'd like somebody in this process to update us.
The charting of obstructions, not every obstruction is charted, and FAA would certainly be the best entity to address this question. So they're not all there. We've got towers that are unmarked and unlit, within close proximity to the airport, some within the approach of an airport, and oftentimes members of the air carriers become aware of that only after they fly into an airport and see the tower. So it's unfortunate, but not all obstructions are on FAA sectionals and charts that pilots use for navigation.
May I follow up?
Senator Dyson, follow up.
Well, I'm not certainly not trying to insert myself into this process, but I think it's certainly within the purview of the state and the Transportation Committee to make sure that there's a real-time working process that new towers that insert themselves into the airspace at beyond some level, that there's a very real process that gets them headed for showing up on the charts. So anyways, somebody in this process, whoever's got the responsibility, I would like to know what that process is and how well it works and in what time frame.
I can briefly speak to that, Senator Dyson. I used to own radio stations, and we're required to light our towers. We're also required to file with the FAA and NOAA, and they're on NOAA charts and on FAA maps, and it has the station and the tower height right on the chart and the map and the aviation map. But that's just for radio stations.
Yeah, and
TV.
Yeah, and I'm very familiar with the NOAA charts. Fortunately, NOAA has made all their charts available online, real-time, for nothing. And a huge, huge aid. Aside from that, you know, Mariners have been using years-old charts that have got jam and coffee all over them. And some of the ones we were using, the bathymetric stuff we were using, was from Captain Vancouver. Anyways, I'm sorry I'm preaching, but I'm very interested in how timely it happens, not how it's supposed to happen, but how timely it happens for Alaska's aviators.
Thank you, Senator Dyson. Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not an aviator, and I'm not a mariner, so this may seem odd, but what height does a small plane typically travel at in Alaska? It seems to me if we raise the elevation on the flight pattern, we wouldn't have the infrastructure issues. So it's one or the other. I get the identification and the need for safety, but how low are these planes flying that we're talking about a 100-foot tower, and how does that play?
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, I'm not a pilot, so I couldn't really answer that. But there is somebody in the room who signed up to testify who's a pilot, and he can probably answer that very well.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Senator French.
Before we get to the witnesses or another witness, maybe I could just ask on page 2, at the top of the page in sub 3 and sub 4, each of those clauses refer to having 4 spherical marker balls attached to each outer guy wire. Is that the idea, to have 4 per wire, or is it 1 per wire? And that's my question.
Through the chair, Senator French, as I read it and in my discussions, it was to have four per guy wire.
So four per wire.
Four per wire.
On the top part, and then four
at a space
per wire.
Every 14 or 15 feet.
Okay. Okay. I just wanted to make sure. Thanks.
Well, I want to follow up, Mr. Senator French, but when you have, you know, like in my community, when you're having Taku winds, that puts a heck of a drag on those guy wires. So we had an issue on electrical lines going across the Douglas Bridge, and when it blows like crazy, that puts a heck of a drag. I don't mean, well, anyway, there's somebody from AELMP that would probably testify to that. We also have Max McGrath from Anchorage Enterprise Tech Services. Mr. McGrath, would you like to provide testimony or just answer questions?
Hi, this is Max McGrath from Enterprise Technology Services. I'm the manager for State of Alaska Telecommunication System, and I'm here to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, Mr. McGrath. And if you can stay online, please, I'm sure we'll find something for to ask you. John Bender, you're online as well, and you're available at Department of Transportation to answer questions. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Great. Thanks, John. We also have Eric Erickson, Alaska Electric Light and Power. Eric, if you can come forward, please, and provide your testimony. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Eric Erickson, Vice President for Alaska Electric Light and Power as Transmission and Distribution Engineer. I would like to provide some testimony supporting exclusion of electrical transmission towers from Senate Bill 177. Acknowledge the honorable intent of protecting the public safety, but there are additional unintended consequences that may be exposed without this exclusion. Implementing this kind of marking on transmission towers would be costly, expose those towers to and electrical service to reliability issues, and exposure to our personnel, employees who are maintaining and implementing these our devices on these towers. They're very remote, high elevations, and so it tends to be a hazardous environment. So I would support excluding electrical transmission towers from Senate Bill 177. If you have any questions for me.
Thanks, Eric. Senator Dyson.
I worked as a construction lineman in my younger and foolish days, mostly wood pole jobs. You don't even remember those. But I assume you operate under some pretty strict rules, and that transmission towers are not are near established airports, and when there are, there's some rules. And I see the yellow or the orange balls on lines crossing rivers and all kinds of things around. I think it would be in your interest to make the point you're making, the regulations and standard practice you already have to address this issue of aircraft encountering power lines.
Senator Dyson, through the chair. Yeah, I would like to affirm and acknowledge that is very true. There are existing regulations that I believe protect the public in that nature related to electrical transmission power lines.
But tell us a little bit, what are you now required to do,
For
particularly on the lines?
Senator, through the chair, for instance, if we're installing a new structure in the proximity of an airport, during the permitting process, there's a review to determine whether there is additional navigational aid markings on maps or structure requirements as far as lighting and things like that. In addition, through the process outside of that kind of close proximity of airports, as it extends out, the requirements lessen. For instance, the Snedisham line, those structures, you go through a permitting process with a since they're on federal property, and that process it would be considered reviewed by the FAA, and they would place those requirements if necessary on the line.
Senator Dyson.
Every transmission line in Alaska I've seen that crosses a river has got the balls on the line.
Yes, the Snedisham line does as well.
And do you know? I assume once you've gone through the permitting process and so on, the process of getting those lines on the charts is out of your hands. When you've done the permitting and all that stuff, then it's somebody else's responsibility, I'm sure, to get them on the maps, charts.
Right. Those lines have been existence for quite a while, so I wasn't directly involved in the permitting of those, but the limited experience I have in permitting those similar projects are that it is the responsibility of the, you know, the owner to follow through with that process of make sure that you know, those markings are as required, are on maps if needed, and lighting if needed through through permitting process.
Okay, I've got a little hearing loss, but did you intend to say it's your responsibility to make sure they get on the maps?
So when we permit, we provide the information to the entities that then put it
we'll
on the
do
maps.
It. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. Erickson? And I apologize, but I had Bob Edukovic from Air Alaska still online to testify. Bob, if I can go off net again and ask you to testify. Mr. Hadukovich, are you online?
Yes.
Okay, if you can testify, please.
Okay, Bob Hadukovich with Air Alaska. This issue came into our world when we started to see kind of a proliferation of cell towers and wind generation devices. The METs, which were mentioned earlier, are generally, they're meteorological towers, and what those are done is they put those up in advance of wind farms to measure, you know, prevailing winds and average speeds to determine the viability. And so they can go up very quickly, and they have it's a very thin tower that goes up with very invisible wires. And so there's a kind of an MET concern out in the rural areas, and then the like I said, the proliferation of cell towers. And they're, if they're below 200 feet, the FAA does not regulate them or does not require them to be registered. And if they're not in the airport environment, they're also unregulated. So the concern for us is that the most likely place to put towers of any sort are near runways, because that's generally where there's power, where there's utilities, where there's maintenance, there's roads. Many communities that we serve, you know, might have one or two roads that go through the entire town, so the most obvious place to put a cell tower or wind generator is on the path towards the runway. Probably most of the accidents that have happened in aviation occur with helicopter-type operations or low-level activities. To answer Senator Faircloth's question, the average height of carriers or airline operations going into airports is generally 1,500 feet to 2,000 feet in the immediate vicinity, and then when you're on approach, you're of course descending from a point to the end of the runway, which brings you down to zero. But that's really where the FAA does their job of maintaining the obstruction clearance, is to make sure that you can have an angled glide path from that 1,500 to 2,000 feet down to the landing point of the runway. So generally speaking, we're not concerned about the approaches as much as we are approaches to airports as much as we are the approaches to the community. Aviators, if private aviation in low weather conditions would tend to follow roads. When you're following the road, like from Fairbanks to Anchorage, you're generally looking out the window and following the road, as opposed to looking out your front window looking for unmarked towers. So the significance of kind of the registration process, I think, is just really important that the state engage in all of this new activity of cell towers and wind generators. I think the electric folks have brought up some great points, and we knew there would be a lot of stakeholders that would engage in this conversation, so we appreciate that input. That's important to this process.
Great. Thank you very much, Bob, for your testimony. Senator Faircloth has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob, I serve on Alaska's Renewable Energy, I don't know if it's not a task force, it's an advisory board, and so I'll take that information to AEA and that process, because we're permitting all those processes now, and I'm not sure why instead of reaching back right now, why we're not going to those that are currently being constructed and requiring some kind of identification. So I would just ask Senator Olson's staff to reach out to the Renewable Energy Advisory Board and just start making that a criteria list in being able to identify those projects, because we're actually doing the feasibility study on the projects right now, and so that's all written in the grants that they're applying to us. So it seems like we could do, instead of a state law change, at least for some of this, we could get out there in front of it right now. Those projects, I think we're considering taking another 23 projects right now into the queue. So, and we know where those other projects are at. It would be less restrictive on the entire industry to go back and look at AEA specifically if we're causing at least that portion of the problem, and then trying to fix the cell tower problem through a piece of legislation.
Hey, sir, thank you.
Mr. Scott, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chairman, I, through the chair, Senator Faircloth, I've taken notes, and I'll definitely reach out to that board.
And I apologize, Eric, that we sort of cut you off so I could get testimony again from Fairbanks, but did you have anything further to add?
No, I just like thank you for your time and appreciate the opportunity to testify.
So I see your boss is here, but he doesn't want to talk.
He put me on the spot today. So.
Perfect. Okay. You did a good job.
Thank you.
That completes testimony, at least that I have. Is there anyone else online that would like to testify? And we will hold this bill over to our next meeting. So Senator Olson has two bills that are being held over. And we have one final bill, and that is Senator Bishop. Senate Bill 178, Passenger Vehicle Rental Tax. And Brittany Hutchison, you will be presenting. Welcome.
Thanks. Are we ready? Okay, thanks.
Have at it.
Thank you. Through the chair, my name is Brittany Hutchison, staff to Senator Bishop. In front of you today is Senate Bill 178, an act relating to the application of the passenger vehicle rental tax. In 2003, the legislature passed a rental vehicle tax intended to raise revenue from tourists using rental cars on the state's road systems. The reasoning behind this legislation was so that non-Alaskans could help pay for the wear and tear that they are putting on our roads during tourist season. The bill was initially intended that the tax, in most cases, would not affect Alaskans. However, that is not the case today. Back in 2004, the bill was amended to exempt taxi cabs from the tax, and it was stated then that it was not the intent of the original bill to negatively impact small businesses, but it is. Beginning in 2013, the Department of Revenue began an attempt to collect the rental vehicle tax from Alaskan businesses who may not even be involved in the tourist industry or rent to tourists. And instead of announcing their new position and applying it prospectively, the Department of Revenue has sought to apply the rental vehicle tax retroactively back to 2004. That would require businesses to pay a 10% rental vehicle tax on all leases for the past 9 years, and these are taxes that were not collected from the clients. This may have a possible consequence of bankrupting small Alaskan businesses. And in your packets, you should have a list of the businesses that are affected by this tax and bill today. Senate Bill 178 amends the rental vehicle tax to make it clear that the tax should not apply to Alaskan businesses that are making long-term rentals to other Alaskan businesses. Specifically, Senate Bill 178 in Section 1 would reduce the lease term exemption from 90 days to 30 days. Section 2 does two things. It reduces the gross vehicle weight from 8,500 pounds to 6,500 pounds so that Alaskan businesses engaged in commercial rentals do not have to be taxed. And also, the second part of Section 2 makes a clarification that this section's exemption applies to the transportation of any goods, whether commercial or personal. And Section 4 makes these changes retroactive to 2004. These changes reflect the original intent of the legislature that the vehicle rental tax would apply to short-term rentals to tourists and not to Alaskan businesses renting to other Alaskan businesses. In summary, this bill is needed because the Department of Revenue is trying to collect 9 years of back taxes, interest, and penalties from Alaskan businesses that were never intended to be taxed in the first place. However, due to DOR's interpretation and application of the vehicle rental tax, they are. Senate Bill 178 aims to clear up any misinterpretation of the Passenger Vehicle Rental Act, rental tax. And online, I have a few people available for testimony and to help answer any questions the committee might have. So with that being said, I thank you for your time and ask for your support on behalf of Senator Bishop.
Great. Thank you for presenting the bill. Senator Dyson.
I'm startled. I may have voted for this thing. And I don't remember understanding it was going to be retroactive back for nearly a long, long time. And I'd be surprised that we can pass a law that incurs a liability for companies. I'm wrong?
I
hope.
I just think there's a misunderstanding.
Good. Help me.
Senator French.
Well, I mean, I'll let the sponsor speak for him or herself, but what happened was we passed a law in 2003 that began taxing rental cars.
Ah.
It's been in place ever since that time.
Okay.
And now some companies have found themselves in a tax dispute with Department of Revenue.
Has revenues changed their mind?
I can't speak to all that. You shouldn't think that we're suddenly passing a law that reaches back that far.
Yeah.
We're passing an exemption that reaches back that far that exempts those years of taxation because of a misunderstanding and a dispute. That's, I think, what's happening.
So I don't have to apologize for my vote.
Well, you still voted for it. But, and I think I did, too. I mean, I'll have to go back and look. And I know it's – I'll just say while we're speaking, I know this is a tricky area. If you look on page 2, sub H, lines 18 and 19 – that's an exemption that I helped push. I think actually Representative Holmes was the person who authored that exemption, but we both sponsored it due to problems with the same kind of thing, a tax falling on, in this case, a very small seasonal group of people that we were spending more to collect the tax than we were collecting, so we exempted. This, I think, is a bigger number involved here, but it's the same idea. It's a tax landing on what some of us came to believe were the wrong people.
Senator Faircloth, by the way, we have 30 minutes left, and we're going to try to get this bill out of here if there, or we can. Now Senator Bishop says we can go ahead and hold it.
Mr. Chairman, is the Department of Revenue online? This fiscal note is quite interesting.
We do have Max Fonder, Tax Division, Department of Revenue. He's available to answer questions. Mr. Fonder, are you available?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the fiscal note, and it's going forward in time, but I'm wondering what it looks like in reverse. It's quite the hefty fiscal note that your department's produced for us, saying about how much am I supposed to? That's how much revenue we're going to lose, or it's going to take 10 people to implement this bill?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Matt Fonder, and I am the director of the Tax Division. My deputy director, Joanna Bales, is the one who drafted this fiscal note, and she was testifying on the sister bill that was in the House side, and she actually just walked in and joined me. But I believe that the way that the fiscal note was drafted for the look back, the reason for the number of employees was simply that the Department of Revenue would have to try to identify and go back and refund taxes to people who rented rental cars that may fall within one of these exemptions during the last 10 years.
So, okay.
Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So to the bill's sponsor, Brittany, I'm concerned about the 90-day exemption, and that's what's creating this payback and trying to find people who've rented. People come to Alaska, they rent motorhomes, and we've been trying to, as you stated, collect from those who are causing deterioration on our highways, basically. And I believe the intent is to try to get commercial vehicle rental out of here, that was never the intent to task Alaskans for Alaskan work and heavier equipment than something that someone might rent. Am I wrong, or help me understand?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, I will try my hardest. If I can't do it to your level, then I do have experts online who might be able to. But I do believe that the intent of the 90 days to 30 days is that most tourists do not rent for over 30 days. And so by making the exemption, moving it to 30 days, anyone over that would be Alaskan businesses, and then they would therefore be exempt. That's what I understand. If that does not answer your question, I would defer to John Cook if he's online.
Mr. Chairman, back to the Department of Revenue then. I know that the fiscal note is quite detailed in the revenue section, but if I'm looking at 1,293,000 you're estimating that we would have to return. Can you tell me, is it the 90 days to 30, or is it another portion of the bill that's causing this particular cost?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, the $1,293,000 is actually for staff that we would need to bring on board to help us work with a refund program, set up a refund program, and identify taxpayers who may have paid the tax that would fall under one of the new exclusions to try to identify them and refund the money to them. The fiscal note also talks about, if you look in, the revenue section, it talks about an actual expected potential reduction of revenues of roughly $800,000 each year if this bill were to pass.
Mr. Chairman, it seems like there's a better way to do this, as in sunsetting the old law and restarting a new law. So the Department of Revenue has been collecting $800,000 from commercial rentals that hasn't been challenged until now. Is that what you're telling me?
Yep. Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, if I could, I'd like to have Joanna Bales respond to your question.
Ms. Bales, if you're available, have at it.
Okay. For the record, this is Joanna Bales, Deputy Director of the Tax Division. What this fiscal note represents is all the different provisions within this bill. So this bill would reduce taxable rentals from the... So anything over 30 days would be exempt. Right now, anything over 90 days is exempt. There also is another provision that reduces the weight of particular vehicles. Any vehicle that is more than 6,500 pounds used to transport personal or commercial property would also be exempt. So what I did in this fiscal note was took a look at actually some records from companies that we'd audited to kind of get an estimate of what type of activity that they had. And I estimate no more than, so approximately 800,000 each year going back for 10 years and then also going forward in lost revenue because of all of the different provisions within this bill that would exempt specific activities. So we would have to evaluate the rental contracts from the last 10 years, all the individual contracts, to determine which contracts would have been exempt had this language been in effect since 2004 forward. And we would work with the approximately, we have about 110 to 120 rental car companies that have remitted tax to us. We would work with them to get copies of contracts. We would also send out public notices that, you know, because a lot of the renters are from out of state, we would be required to refund taxes paid if their rental car contracts meet the new exemption criteria.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Bales, I have a hard time hiring 10 state employees to go back through records to 2004, but I find it challenging that we have what appears to be a new interpretation at the Department of Revenue, or a new greater understanding maybe in the best light of what the legislature meant with the language. So we're not going to go back reflectively and try to collect tax, right? I mean, you wouldn't hire 10 people and go back and see what tax we didn't collect. Is there another way to do this if we only go? When did the challenges start coming to the Department of Revenue? Was it a year ago or 2 years ago? Instead of going back to 2004, could we go back to 2012?
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, and that would be up to the sponsor of the bill in terms of how they would want to handle this. In terms of what we've done here in the department, I do want to stress that this is not a new interpretation by the department of the statutes that have been on the books since 2004. It had just come to our attention that there were some companies that were conducting vehicle rentals that met the criteria where they should have been collecting or remitting tax that we were not aware of, just because some of the compliance programs that we do, we look for companies that say on their business license have identified that they're a vehicle rental company. So companies that say that do heavy equipment leasing, we didn't either recognize or realize that they also had vehicle rental that met this criteria. So it's with every program we have, we do conduct compliance projects to see if there are any taxpayers that need to be educated and need to come back into compliance. As far as the fiscal note goes, these positions in our mind would be needed for the retroactivity provision of the bill to ensure that all the consumers who paid the tax to the rental car companies would be refunded, which is what this would require. However, without the retroactivity provision, we would have a zero fiscal note in terms of needing new people to implement the new provisions going forward prospectively.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Ms. Bales. I appreciate the position of the department and I look forward to working with the sponsor. I think that we have a problem that's been identified. I don't want to speak for others in the body. I believe I voted in favor of this bill. My understanding when we voted for it was that it was for folks coming in at the Anchorage International Airport or otherwise renting a motorhome from someone or a vehicle that they would go explore Alaska, and that it was never the intent of the legislature to pick up commercial rentals or long-term leases for equipment that's moving to and from and being used by Alaskans. But that's the question that will be before our body, hopefully at some point. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Faircloth, I agree. The problem is I think we're getting confused about when you say car rental, but then when we're talking about this legislation, we're talking businesses affected by the tax. We have 14 businesses listed that are affected by the tax, and there's not an Avis, there's not a Hertz, there's not a National, there's not a Budget. There are ASRC Energy Services, like what, CH2M Hill. Aren't these commercial leases? Senator Bishop?
Mr. Chairman, I think, the intent of the bill is to get back to the original intent of 2004 of doing just exactly what the legislation was intended to do in 2004, and that's to tax the rental cars and our summer tourism, and I don't believe the intent of the bill was to go tax Alaska businesses that are doing business in Alaska, and especially when a lot of these businesses that you just described are doing business in mining, oil patch related work, operating off unimproved roads with no state support, no state maintenance, etc. So that's what we're trying to do, is to make sure that I think these people just got caught up in some unintended consequences, and we're trying to rectify that.
Great. Thank you, Senator Bishop. We do have people signed up to testify, and we're getting close to running out of time. But we have someone in the audience, Ryan Peterkin, Kenai Spur Highway, Matek, Alaska. Mr. Peterkin, welcome.
Thank you, Chairman and Senators. My name's Ryan Peterkin. I'm from Kenai, Alaska. I'm a fourth-generation Alaskan, four generations of Alaska business as well. My great-grandpa came up here in 1916, railroad. He got into private business through the Eastside Dairy, later sold in 1940 to Matanuskamaid Dairy. And I'm currently the president of Matek Alaska. We have two locations, one in Kenai and one in Prudhoe Bay. Pickup trucks is a byproduct of our equipment rentals, basically. We rent industrial equipment, but to satisfy our clientele, pickup trucks is a part of the business. We employ over 75 Alaskans with an average salary in Alaska of $77,000 a year, totaling about $6 million worth of salaries into the state of Alaska. I'm in support of the SB 178. As I first learned about it, the rental vehicle tax, for the very first time on November 6th, when I got a call from my Prudhoe Bay operation, when James Kurth, a criminal investigator and an armed enforcement officer, arrived at my Prudhoe Bay facility. They instructed us, basically, that we were in violation. There would be criminal charges if we didn't comply with them. Of that nature, and to contact Jonathan Page and the Anchorage office. We did that directly that evening. It was about 5 o'clock. We got a hold of them the next morning. We went through this and we explained to them our line of business. We were trying to interpret what was on the state website under the tax, going through the law. There's a lot of different interpretations of this. All of our vehicles that we thought we'd be able to get an exemption in, they told us it was a U-Haul tax, and personal property was like a couch or moving household goods, to where we understood personal property as being our safety gear, laptop computers, or etc. There's other issues that makes this almost impossible for us to implement, to be able to legitimately give a fair shake to the state of Alaska, which we fully intend to do. But it's a 90-day period, and if the lease extends over, if we have a six-month contract, we get an exemption for that 6 months. If our client extends for another 6 months, that 6 months is taxable. They won't allow us to. It's that contract is closed. It's a new one. So, and most of our contracts, we work off of master service agreements. They're multiple years for the oil companies. So, you know, they don't tell us if they're keeping them for 1 to 6 months. But all of our leases, all of our pickup truck rentals and leases are in commercial applications. They're in Prudhoe Bay, 90% of them, and the other 10% are in the Kenai Peninsula, which 5% of that are on the west side of the Cook Inlet on dirt roads and gravel, mostly. It's the 6,500 GVWR would be beneficial, because oil companies have went to these half-ton crew cab pickup trucks, more cost-effective, less impact to the road, etc. However, that would be a benefit to our business as well. Being a retroactive tax, I find out on this on November 6, 2013, to get in a letter a couple years later inviting us to pay back taxes on the pickup trucks would be devastating to our business. If it didn't put us out of business, we would have to seek financial aid. For sure, we're a growing business. We're trying to respond to clientele, and we just don't have that kind of money in reserve to be able to pay a back tax like that. We never collected the tax, nor did we ever get a notice of the tax by a phone call, by a letter, or by any other means of communication other than when we were blindsided with a criminal investigator and an enforcement officer that showed up in our Prudhoe Bay facility.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Peterkin. And I'm assuming because your vehicles are getting larger, right?
Mr. Chairman, all of our vehicles are half-ton pickup trucks to three-quarter tons, some one-ton pickup trucks. All of them are rented to oil and gas companies, commercial applications, nothing to a private individual. If you don't have a...
So when you're talking gross vehicle weight, that hasn't changed?
Our gross vehicle weights probably range from 7,000 pounds on the low side to 12,000 pounds on the high side.
Thank you. Senator French. I will take just a couple more folks to testify, Mr. Let's see. No, never mind. You're not here. Thank you very much, Mr. Peterkin, for coming down and testifying today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators.
Yeah, do we, John Cook, are you online? Well, and just to let you folks know, we're running out of time. We all have additional committee meetings that we have starting here very shortly. So, Mr. Cook, are you online? Airport equipment rentals?
Yes, Mr. Chair, can you hear me?
Yep, welcome. Loud and clear.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is John Cook. I'm Chief Financial Officer of Airport Equipment Rentals, Inc. In Fairbanks, Alaska. I'd like to thank you and the committee members for allowing me the opportunity to testify in support of SB 178. Airport Equipment is a Fairbanks-based family-owned business employing 125 people, locations in Dead Horse, Fairbanks, Delta, Anchorage, and Kenai. We are the John Deere Construction Equipment Dealer for Alaska, and we are also the largest equipment rental company in Alaska, representing a variety of manufacturers. Primarily as a customer service, we offer incidental rentals to our construction equipment customers, primarily to producers and Alaska contractors in the North Slope. Most of our rentals are several months and often years in duration. Out of 5,000 rental units, 150 of those are trucks. The rest is heavy equipment and other pieces of non-mobile equipment. Senator French and Senator Dyson and Senator Faircloth, I too have familiarity with this tax and its entire legislative history. Our company's owned the National Car Rental Concession at the Fairbanks Airport through May of 2013. And many of you that have been around a long time know that prior to my employment in Airport Equipment, I'm a reformed car dealer. I was owned a car dealership with rental operations dating back to 1994. The original intent of the tax is very clear. It's been gone over that it was meant to help to tax tourists to help fund road maintenance and tourism marketing. Some of the concerns, I guess, that we have regarding Department of Revenue and the retroactive reinterpretation of the statutes is that it's contrary to the legislature's intent, specifically with regard to long-term rentals of pickup trucks between Alaska businesses and primarily on the North Slope. Our company had and continues to pay the rental taxes. We've been aware of this being the National Car Rental Dealership. We were made of these recent developments by the department to retroactively collect the tax by some of our competitors. Some of which you've heard from today, and hopefully you'll hear from the rest as we move through the process. I have the utmost respect for Ms. Bales, the Department of Revenue, its employees, and understand they're just trying to do their job and protect the best interests of the state. But some of their interpretations of the statute and assertions are very concerning. I do believe if this legislation is not passed and the department attempts to retroactively collect this tax from Alaska businesses, that several of those companies will have to declare bankruptcy. And between you and me, if for nothing else but for selfish reasons, the truck rental business is a low-margin business that we're not interested in. So I'd like to keep these competitors around, let them keep renting the trucks, and we'll rent all the fun stuff. But specifically, I guess, with regard, and again, we just received the department's fiscal note this morning. I'll go into that at the end if I have time. But
yeah, Mr. Cook, if you can... I apologize, but we're running out of time.
Gotcha. I'll keep it real clear.
And you're more than welcome to testify again next week.
Yep. You want me to stop right now? I'm happy to
do that. No, go ahead. Go ahead. You have about a minute left.
Okay. And maybe I'll come back later. We'd like to discuss the 90-day interpretation, which has already been previously mentioned. Currently, the statute exempts vehicles over 8,500 gross vehicle weight to transport personal property. The personal property is not defined in the statutes. Frankly, pickups are personal property. What they haul is personal property. Senator French would be somebody that I'd trust to look into this. Lastly, specifically with regard to North Slope Rentals, AS43.52.099, subsection 2, defines a passenger vehicle as a motor vehicle that's driven on a highway or public right-of-way. The North Slope Road System is not a public road or a public right-of-way. It is a private road system. So, you know, for many reasons, I think some of the folks that the department is trying to collect from, there might be some other challenges that they haven't really thought through. With regard to needing 10 people to refund the tax, I guess I'm a little unclear on that. The state has no record of who collected the tax. For businesses that collected that tax from their customers and remitted it to the department, I know as a National Alamo concessionaire, I don't have records that go back 10 years old. I'm not interested in spending our time to try to go and refund taxes to customers. There's no benefit into me to pay it or not pay it. We collected it, we remitted it. So I'm not sure, again, I guess that would be something to get into down the road on why there would need to be 10 employees and perhaps overestimating the effect. But, again, I appreciate the department had to provide that on short notice, the fiscal note. So I'll leave it for now. Hopefully I can come back later and talk more to you.
You're more than welcome to come back, but if we can, but next meeting we will try to limit testimony to 3 or 4 minutes maximum. And I do appreciate, on behalf of the entire committee, all the letters that we've received in support of some form of 178, and we will through Senator Bishop and Ms. Hutchison work on coming to an amiable conclusion that everybody can live with. Senator Dyson.
Yeah. Question to Senator Bishop. Is the department still going after these enforcement actions now, and or should we take some action, tell them to knock it off until we get this stuff resolved?
That I'm not, I don't, Senator Dyson, I don't know what, if the DOR is doing that or not, if they're continuing to go forward. I don't know.
Well, I would encourage us to find out.
And I'm assuming,
but I understand.
I'm assuming Mr. Fonder is still online and is listening to you, Senator Dyson.
Well,
and Ms. Bales. And again, I apologize to Mr. Bryce, Mr. Johnson, Tom Pellegrim, that we didn't get to your testimony, but the committee just flat out ran out of time, and we have another committee that's scheduled in this room starting momentarily. So we will continue this meeting, and you're more than welcome to call back in, courtesy of the Legislative Information Office and OffNet. And again, we apologize for the length of the meeting, but we will continue all three bills, hopefully next Tuesday. And again, our thanks to Alita Buss and Krekelberg and Kathleen Nyson for assisting the committee today. Without further ado, meeting's